The following broadcast of the Penn State Forum was recorded January 17, 2007.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Nittany Lion Inn and to today's Penn State Forum. I'm Patty Satalia from Penn State Public Broadcasting. Our thank you, as always, to Tom Bauer and the Penn State Bookstore for their continued support of this event, which today is being recorded by CNET. It's also being distributed to other Penn State campuses over the Internet. We have a great program for you today and a number of exciting events to come this year. Check out the blue tents that you'll see on your tables for more details and mark your calendars now for Monday, January 29th. The forum will be held at the Nittany Lion Inn and our guest speaker is Albie Hecht, who is president of Worldwide Biggies, Inc. The title of his talk is Creating New Entertainment Experiences for the Digital Family. Each semester, students are invited to these special luncheons, and we've been fortunate over the years to get a handful of them to volunteer to write articles about the Penn State Forum, and that is a job that Salim Carter, who's sitting over here, has been doing for us for quite some time. He's an undergraduate student studying history at Penn State. So thank you, Salim. We appreciate your efforts. The winner of today's random drawing is David Passmore in Keller Building. Congratulations to David. He has lunch for two at the Penn State Nittany Lion Inn. And for those who are new to the Penn State Forum, our program is modeled after the National Press Club. It begins with a 30-minute presentation followed by Q&A. There are notepads and pens at each table, and Barton Browning and Betts Hanley will be circulating throughout the room to collect your written questions. If you haven't already done so, please turn off your cell phones. And now to introduce today's guest speaker, here's Penn State's Blanny Bowen, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs.
Thanks, Patty. Good afternoon. The presidential election in 2000 exposed some shortcomings in election procedures. Since then, election officials have studied ways to increase voter confidence and ensure the security and integrity of votes. Complex election issues include the security of electronic voting machines, the need for voter-verified paper ballots, policies for absentee ballots, and accessibility for voters with disabilities. Today's speaker works in the midst of all of these issues. He is the Honorable Pedro Cortez, Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Secretary Cortez administers the Pennsylvania Department of State, which is the agency charged with overseeing the state's electoral process. He is the Commonwealth's chief election official. Secretary Cortez was nominated as Secretary of the Commonwealth by Governor Rendell in April of 2003 and confirmed by the Senate in May of 2003, making him the first Hispanic or Latino confirmed as a cabinet member in Pennsylvania. In addition to overseeing Pennsylvania's electoral process, the Department of State protects the public's health, safety, and welfare by licensing business, health, and real estate professionals, maintaining registration and financial information for charities operating in Pennsylvania, and maintaining corporate filings. Secretary Cortez has previously served as Executive Director of Pennsylvania Governor's Advisory Commission on Latino Affairs. He's also served as Pennsylvania's State Civil Service Commission, served on with the commission, and the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare. He earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Massachusetts, a Master of Public Administration from Penn State and Penn State Harrisburg, and a law degree from Penn State Dickinson School of Law. Secretary Cortez has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Hispanic Business Magazine's 100 Most Influential Hispanics in the U.S., Central Penn Business Journal's Top 40 Under 40 Business Leaders in Central Pennsylvania, and American Lawyer Media's Lawyers on the Fast Track. He was also selected as a Penn State Alumni Fellow in 2005, the most prestigious honor given by the Penn State Alumni Association. Secretary Cortez recently chaired an election reform task force which evaluated and made recommendations for improving the electoral process in the Commonwealth. His topic today is a historical perspective on voting in Pennsylvania. Please give a warm welcome to the Honorable Pedro Cortez, Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Provost Bowen, and good afternoon, everyone. It's wonderful, wonderful to be here at Penn State. I rejoice every time I have an opportunity to come and visit State College, even though I did not go to school here. As you heard, I went to school in Harrisburg as well as Carlisle. Penn State has a special place in my heart, and the reason for that is because we have a rich tradition of a school of quality, diversity, and the fact that now, especially when I was studying at Dickinson, I was initially part of the Dickinson School of Law, the private school. And I remember going to Puerto Rico and to Florida and speaking with people about what I was doing at the time. And eventually we got around to the fact that I was attending law school, and they will say, where do you go to school? And I say, the Dickinson School of Law. I'm very proud of Dickinson. And they will look at me and say, is that ABA approved or accredited by the American Bar Association? And I said, absolutely. It's the oldest of the law school. Governor Tom Ridge went there. But I had to do all that explaining. And then after we merged with Penn State, I would go around, and if people ask me what I was doing, I say, oh, I go to school at Dickinson. And they say, oh, and what is that or where is that? And I say, oh, Penn State Dickinson. Yeah, Joe Paterno. Yeah, you guys are good. So it's good to be associated with Penn State. And I'm sure all of you are also proud of that association. On behalf of Governor Ed Rendell, it is for me a great pleasure to be here and participate in the forum, but also to be able to share with you thoughts about elections, the electoral process in general. And I call it the electoral process. In fact, I should call it the election system, because oftentimes when we talk about elections, we think about election day. In fact, I know one of the challenges that the election officials, the local administrators have, is getting their, sometimes their county commissioners and others to recognize that they work more than 2 days a year. In fact, it's a job that is 365 and a quarter days a year. A day does not go by that you're not thinking about the next election and how you make it better. And it's a process that starts from, you know, nomination petitions and nomination papers and runs the gamut through election day and the post-certification process and all of that. I know there's a lot of interest in terms of the voting systems, and rightly so. It's an important tool, but it's one component of a broader project. Before I proceed further, I do want to extend my gratitude to Ms. Carol Griffin, who is the coordinator for the Penn State Forum, for inviting me, and all the distinguished members of the faculty staff club for having me here. It is, again, a great honor to have this opportunity to share, get some thoughts with you. There's one person that I'm going to single out for recognition. She's a member of your staff and has been a member of your staff for over 20 years, and she is Maria Schmidt, who is with us here. And the reason I'm singling out Maria, not only because she's a very good friend of mine, is because Maria is a commissioner of the Governor's Advisory Commission on Latino Affairs, and she's the representative for Center County and this part of the state, and that's a distinction that this area has not enjoyed in the past in terms of having a representative of the commission. So, Maria, thank you for your service, and thank you for everything you do for Penn State and for the Latino community. Again, for me, it's an honor and a great pleasure to speak with you about what is often considered the most fundamental right of citizenship that we enjoy in our country, and that is the right to elect our public officials. Many people feel that this is the most fundamental right because everything follows, everything that we enjoy in terms of our rights and our liberties come or stem out of the ability to elect the people who represent us at the federal level, the state level, the local level. For those who think, well, elections are not important, I don't vote because I'm one vote, or I don't vote because, hey, my voice will get lost, or who cares, the elected officials are not making decisions that are relevant to me. I would say, think again. Even for young people, the fact is that, if you're in college, Sometimes your tuition, financial aid, a number of those factors are determined by people in elected office. And you hardly will go through life a single day that you're not leaving the realities of someone else making decisions for you. In our democracy, the way we let our views and our voice be heard is through the ballot. When Ben Franklin and Alexander Hamilton and others framed the U.S. Constitution back in 1787, their vision was to assemble a more perfect union, a union that would recognize people for the values that everybody would bring to the table. And as you know, our Constitution began with those very important words of "we the people." But back then, in 1787, that perfect union and that "we the people," by and large, meant, in the case of voting, for example, meant white male landowners. It didn't mean everyone. And, I mean, it was what it was. I guess no sense complaining about it at this state of the game. But it is important to recognize that that was the beginning, and you have to start somewhere. And I believe that was an excellent beginning for our nation, and we're all indebted to our forefathers for their wisdom and for their foresight. But it has taken over 200 years to create a democracy, a system of government that is more inclusive of more members of our community and of our society. And that 200 years at times have been seen as a struggle, and many courageous people have participated in what we enjoy today in terms of our liberties in electing our officials. So today, what I'd like to do, as it was noted already, is to provide remarks on the evolution of voting in the United States and our road to an ideal and more perfect union. And then also give you a little bit of my perspective, from my standpoint, how I saw the development of the 2006 primary election as well as the general election. And I will speak, I understand, for about half an hour and then open the floor and hope that you have lots of good questions. If you don't have good questions, I always take good jokes. You have to keep them clean. And I also take recipes, especially for desserts. I love sweets. So let me take you back. This is going to be a historical trip. And I'm going to take you back. As we talked about the Constitution being framed in 1787, being ratified in 1789. And it takes we have to go until the year 1870 with the enactment, the ratification of the 15th Amendment, to get to that point where we have a large segment of our population. And I'm talking about, in the case of race, blacks, African Americans, those who had a condition of servitude in the past. It takes us, we have to wait until 1870 and the passage of the 15th Amendment to finally, after almost 100 years of the history of our nation, to allow blacks to vote. That seems, 100 years, a long time for that to happen, but it did happen. Equally puzzling to me, as someone who grew up among women and lives among women today, is that we had to wait until the year 1920 to see the passage of the 19th Amendment through the suffrage movement and get a lot of courageous people to get us to the point where we can now allow women to vote. I'm talking about 1920, not even 100 years. If you're familiar with our states and the District of Columbia, and if you visit Washington, you see that the district has in their on their license plate their slogan, taxation without representation. And that's a whole issue about people who feel that they're paying their fair share but not having an opportunity to fully voice their preference in government. And it was not until the year 1961 and the passage of the 23rd Amendment that finally the residents of the District of Columbia are allowed to vote for the president, despite the fact that they are members of the union and, in fact, host the seat of Congress. Again, and please understand that this discussion, I'm just citing factual realities of our history. And this is not intended to be critical. It's just to give you a sense of where we've been through the years because I believe with that we will have a better understanding of where we're headed, and in terms of, at the same time also understand the realities of our electoral process today. But in the year 1961, so the passage of the 23rd Amendment, and that's what provided for the Electoral College and the voting of the members of the District of Columbia. I know there's a big controversy to this day where other territories, or the territories of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and American Samoa and Guam, still do not vote for the presidency, even though individuals from those territories are U.S. citizens by birth. That's probably for the Q&A period and for maybe if not another day. But that's still a point of contention. And in the case of those territories, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that the people in those territories do not pay federal tax. But that only applies, I'm going to speak about the case of Puerto Rico since I am born and raised in, on the island, and I know the history fairly well. The taxes, you know, people in Puerto Rico pay Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare. They do pay, if you're a federal employee, you pay federal taxes, income taxes, that is. And if you happen to work outside of Puerto Rico, and live in Puerto Rico, but you work outside of Puerto Rico, maybe you have business in other parts of the Caribbean, you also pay federal income taxes. And there's that issue about there's some of the territories still not having the representation. It's not until the year 1964, with the passage of the 24th Amendment, that we deal with the issue of the poll tax. And as you remember, there was a time, in fact, until 1964, that there was some states will charge a tax for you to have the right to vote. And this also manifested itself in that if you owe taxes to the federal government, you were preempted from voting. And with the passage of the 24th Amendment, the state saw the wisdom of saying people should not be deprived of their most fundamental right of citizenship in lieu of the taxes. You know, 1964 is significant because it's the same year we have the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Speaking the seminal words in his memorable speech of I Have a Dream. And that's the beginning. I mean, do you see now through the 60s and the civil rights movement a sentiment, a growing sentiment, very vocal, that says there's other elements, not just election, but there are many other elements in society that we need to address. And with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we begin to see doors opening. And remember, I mentioned that back in the 1870s, with the passage of the 15th Amendment, you had blacks and others were able to vote. However, you know, the dream was not fully realized, as Dr. King so eloquently stated back in 1964. The good thing is that as a result of the passage of the 24th Amendment in 1964 with the poll tax and the interest in civil rights in the country, then we see in the year 1965 the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act, in fact, was just reauthorized last year in the summer of 2006, and it has to be reauthorized every so many years to make sure that elements of the act are still applicable and can be, in fact, enforced by the federal government, and the enforcing body being the U.S. Department of Justice. And this is, perhaps, in terms of voting, the most important political, legal mandate, because it speaks so clearly about the rights that different voters have. I'd like to talk to you briefly about several different sections of the Voting Rights Act and tell you what are their significance. Understand that when we're talking about the Voting Rights Act that speaks to issues of people with limited English proficiency and people with disabilities, but let's just talk to people with limited English proficiency. That's associated with people who are not native born. So remember here that we're talking about the right to vote, and the right to vote is limited to citizens. So this is not a discussion about undocumented immigration. Keep in mind when you think, why are we making those accommodations for, sometimes people say, for those people? That we have to produce ballots in other languages. Why are we doing it? You know, darn it, this is America. Learn the language. Well, people are trying to learn, but there is a learning curve. But these are applicable, again, to citizens, people that have that most fundamental right to vote. Section two of the Voting Rights Act. This is a provision of the act that speaks to systemic intimidation and voting hostility. And in the 60s and before that, it was very prevalent that you would have someone at the polls, even though now people couldn't charge you a tax, but there would be people there that you could have maybe figures of authority in uniform. You know, you will have police officers, member of the military, right outside the polling place, and or have the poll workers, so the administrative, engage in sometimes very subtle, sometimes very overt forms of intimidation. And the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibit that type of conduct. And when you look at intimidation, by the way, it's reviewed in terms of the totality of the circumstances. Like I said, sometimes it's very subtle. But when you piece all that together, sometimes you see that there are given communities that are still not open to all of its citizens. I mentioned the citizens from Puerto Rico, and there's a section in the Act, Section 4E, E as in Edward, 4E. And this is the section of the Act that says, you as a state or local election official cannot discriminate in voting or make as a condition of voting a person's ability to speak English. And the passage of this Act was very specific, having in mind the people from Puerto Rico who happen to be U.S. citizens by birth but educated in U.S. flag schools where the primary language of instruction was Spanish and not English. And as you understand, the people from Puerto Rico have the freedom to come to the mainland and move here just like if you were moving from New Jersey to Pennsylvania. And when that person comes as a U.S. citizen, you have to be able to provide a meaningful opportunity for that person to vote. And if the person cannot understand what the ballot says, you have to make that accommodation. Section 203 of the Act also speaks similarly to the issue of those who are limited English proficiency, but it's not looking only at the people from Puerto Rico that are educated in U.S. flag schools where the primary language of instruction is a language other than English, but it's looking in general, again, to citizen communities, but looking where you have communities is what is known, Section 203 is a 5%, 5% test, and that is if you're able to show that a given county or a given section of a given political subdivision has 5% or more of the people who are from a given speakers of a given language other than English, that when you have the census data, they indicate that they're limited in their ability to speak English. In other words, they speak English less than well. And if you have a community that has more than 5% or 10,000 in the aggregate that are people who are citizens, but in fact, it's not, in that case, for the census, it's not limited to citizenship because the census doesn't look at citizenship. But if you look at a community that has 5% or 10,000 where people cannot communicate in English very well, that triggers a test that says you have to provide the services in the language of the people who are in that given group. And in the state of Pennsylvania, the only jurisdiction, the only county to which this is applicable is Philadelphia County. The city of Philadelphia is one and the same. It's the only county that meets that test. However, Section 2E and Section 2, the voter intimidation, and 4E, the section that applicable to mostly people from Puerto Rico, has already been triggered in our state outside of Philadelphia. And more recently, that happened in the year 2003 in Berks County, Reading more specifically, where you have a growing Spanish-speaking community. And despite the fact that the Department of Justice had already alerted the election officials in the county that they had this growing community that had to be serviced, in this case in Spanish. And what that means by service means that you have to provide ballots, in this case in Spanish, that you have to have poll workers that are able to communicate in Spanish, bilingual, Spanish and English, to assist those voters. Despite being told you have to do so, Berks County outright said, no, we won't. And it was a sad day in our history when, in fact, a former county commissioner of Berks County went on record to say, I will not let that happen in my county, bring those ballots in Spanish. Because if I do that, that will be the day that one of those people are going to come and run my city of Reading. And it almost, you know, said, you know, I won't let that happen. I cannot have those people. And if I provide those ballots in Spanish, it's the end of life as we know it. I wish it's sad, because I hope people understand. I hope I'm preaching to the choir when we talk about the value of diversity and the fact that everybody's here trying to better themselves, trying to better their family, trying to contribute. But those were the words of that commissioner, and there was a sentiment of many others. And the good thing is that to the detriment of the taxpayers in Berks County, ultimately the federal government, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District ruled against Berks County and then forced Berks County to provide that assistance in Spanish. The moral of the story being that if there's something that you see, if you see the writing on the wall, you might as well go ahead, be proactive, provide the services that are legally required, and then you come ahead in the game. People see you as being very proactive, very protective of our democracy, and then you have perhaps good publicity and life goes on. Or you can take the hard road of Berks County and go through all that misery, pay thousands upon thousands of dollars in legal fees, be embarrassed to no end, and then ultimately have to do it anyhow. Good thing that came out of the case in Berks County is that much credit to the New York commissioners in Berks County. They have not only complied with the requirements of the law, they have in fact gone above and beyond and provided other services to the community there. And good thing too is that other communities in Pennsylvania, other counties that are seeing a growth in the Latino Hispanic community are acting on their own initiative to provide those services, despite the fact that they don't fall under Section 203, the 5%, despite the fact that they don't have a history of systemic hostility or perhaps don't have a sizable Puerto Rican community. They're still providing those services because they see that in fact the services are needed, and they are taking advantage of the good publicity that way. Finally, with regards to the Voting Rights Act, another very important section for people to keep in mind is Section 208, and that is the section that speaks to assisters of the voter's choice, meaning if you're a person who is physically disabled or you happen to be a person with limited English proficiency, and you then have the right to bring someone of your choice to the polling place with you, and that person can go inside the booth and assist you voting. Not the ideal way for people with disabilities to vote. Most people want to vote independently, and I'll talk briefly about the Help America Vote Act of 2002, which provides for voting systems that are accessible to people with disabilities. But Section 208 back in 1965 said if you are someone with limited English proficiency or you have a physical disability, you can have someone you can bring someone of your choice to go with you in the polling place and have that person help you vote. The only limitations is the person that comes with you cannot be your employer, nor can it be a representative from your union. And the reason for that is to avoid perhaps any coercion in the way you vote. 1971, going back to the amendments, 1971, see the passage of the 26th Amendment. That's the amendment that lowered the voting age from 21 years to 18 years, and at that time, as you may remember, we were engulfed in the tail end of the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of discussion about, you know, sending to war people who are 17, 18, 19, 20, and asking them to defend the country, but not giving them the opportunity to participate in the electoral process. So the age was lowered. At that time in Pennsylvania, when you're going to pass an amendment, by the way, you have to have that amendment has to be passed in Congress and then has to be ratified by 2/3 of the state. And in Pennsylvania at the time, a former Secretary of the Commonwealth, Secretary C. Dolores Tucker, the first African-American woman Secretary of State in the nation, was Secretary of State in Pennsylvania. She was very instrumental in getting Pennsylvania to ratify that amendment. The year 2000, you know, it was mentioned briefly about the elections, the mood of elections, and the overall interest of elections changed dramatically during the elections of the presidential elections of 2000, the Bush versus Gore race. And there's a lot of discussion that is still taking place today about who was elected and how that worked, the Electoral College. Good thing about it, I'm an optimist. I'm always looking for the bright side and the silver line. The good thing is that it happened. Congress got to work, passed in 2002 the Help America Vote Act, and that's an act that is looking to provide for three things: elections that are fair, that are accurate, and that are accessible. And as a result of the Help America Vote Act, states were required to implement a statewide voter registration system. Instead of going from every county having their own voter registration system, the state had to put together a statewide registry. Also, the act outlawed the use of Lieber machines, which is where the system used here in Center County, were they Lieber machines? Not the paper? The punch cards, yeah. So it allowed punch cards and it allowed the use of Lieber machines on grounds that the system were not very reliable in terms of errors and also were not very friendly to people with disabilities. And this is why now in Pennsylvania you saw the move in the case here of Center County to move from the punch cards to the direct recording electronic voting systems, the ones that are the touch screen. And I'm sure that that's going to trigger some questions during the Q&A. But let me give you a sense to conclude, because my time for my initial 30 minutes is coming to an end. Let me give you a sense of the elections for this back in the primary on May 6th and the general election on November 7th to give you a sense of the magnitude of the process, and also to put it in context. When sometimes I know it's easy to say, oh, things are not working, it's easy to be critical and point to an error here, an error there, but keep this in mind as you think about the electoral process in Pennsylvania. This last, over the last couple of elections, first of all, keep in mind that Pennsylvania is a state of 12.4 million people, of which about 8.1 million are registered to vote. For the last general election, we had over 4 million people participate on election day. So we almost have 50% of everyone who was registered to vote voting. So 4 million, the highest number for the last three general elections. 4 million voters, 25,623 voting systems, voting machines, 9,271 polling places, and you have humans and machines interacting, and that is indeed a massive endeavor. So keep in mind, 4 million voters, close to 26,000 polling voting machines, 9,271 polling places. As with every election, there were some issues, some problems that arose in this election, mainly human errors. They occur as they usually do. At the opening of the polls, you have a long line waiting, and despite the fact that we, at the Department of State and the counties, do the best we can with the help of many interest groups, try to train our poll workers and get them ready to be there for election day, there are some issues that take place. And the important thing, though, is not so much that counties had trouble with their opening of the polls, is are you prepared to do something about it? Or do I go into a panic and throw my hands up in the air and say, oh, the world's coming to an end? Good thing is that the counties were prepared. By and large, the problems were resolved within the first hour or two of the opening of the polls. In fact, after 10 o'clock, the different hotlines that people could call at the Department of State and otherwise, the amount of calls was greatly reduced. And by all accounts, the elections went very well. Again, not perfect, but there's not a single perfect election, even back in the days where we had the punch cards and the paper ballots as well as the Lieber machines. When I talked about the elections going well, you know, it's easy for me to say and for people to think, well, he's just simply partial because he's a chief election official. So when he says the elections go good, you know, those words are suspicious. And I take that as a valid thought in your mind. But let me share with you to close a couple of observations made by the people who are at the federal level charged with overseeing elections in Pennsylvania and in other parts of the country and what they have to say about our state in Pennsylvania. And these are comments that came from for the primary election on May 16th. And I think these are relevant because this is the first election in Pennsylvania where we were required under the Help America Vote Act to have the new voting systems in place, and the counties were under a tight schedule to get that done. Mr. Won Kim, Special Attorney General in charge of the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, in July during the National Association of Secretaries of State Conference, went on to identify four states that the Department of Justice, looking at the entire country, thought that they had performed the elections exceptionally well considering the demands of the time and new requirements. And he singled out Kentucky, Illinois, Texas, and, yes, Pennsylvania. Mr. Paul DiGregorio, the chairperson of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, the federal agency created by the Help America Vote Act to supervise the administration of the elections, was in Pennsylvania for the May 16th primary, and he visited Allegheny, Butler, and Westmoreland County. And in feedback following his presence and his visit to Pennsylvania, he spoke glowingly about what he saw and the level of preparedness. Again, not perfect, but what he saw was very good. And he made those comments at several venues. And the interesting thing is that the first time I heard him said that, and this was at the University of Maryland, talking about the security of voting systems and accessibility, when I was sitting at the same table he was, and he got up, he made this comment, he was talking about his experience in Pennsylvania, how good it was. I figured he was just being polite because I was there, and he was just being politically correct. Well, we had also my colleagues from North Carolina and California in the room as well. And after he finished talking about Pennsylvania, he went on to heavily criticize both North Carolina and California for being unprepared and creating all sorts of headaches for their voters for the primary election. So these are folks that are in charge of keeping a close eye in Pennsylvania. And if we don't do things right, they don't have any reservation about suing us for not doing our job. So with that, I'm going to open the floor for questions. I know we have a moderator for the questions. And again, it's a great pleasure for me to be here. I hope that if we don't have the time to answer your questions or you have a question that doesn't come to you until, you know, 1 o'clock, that you will do take the time to reach out to us at the Department of State. We're very proud of being very customer-focused and oriented towards reaching out or having a conversation with the public. So I hope you will take the time to write to me or call us at the office, and we will be happy to provide more information about anything I talked about today or to answer questions that you may have relative to an election or the other work that we do at the Department of State. Thank you.
Your first question is a softball. Regarding desserts, what is dulce de leche, and how can I make it from supermarket ingredients? And I hope pronounce that correctly for us, if you would, too.
Yeah, dulce de leche. Dulce means candy, and leche being milk. It's a dulce de leche, and I'm sure somebody might have a better recipe than I do. There's a dulce de leche that also incorporates rice and sometimes has raisins. And coconut. I have a recipe that I could probably send someone, but it's a very, very good dessert, and you may also want to try flan or the cheese custard, my favorite. So also another easy recipe that I'll be glad to share with the group.
We got at least four questions about the voting machines, and I'm going to read two of them to you. Today, 27 states require electronic voting machines to produce a voter-verified paper trail. Is Pennsylvania likely to join this group? And I'll read the second before you answer. We're being asked to trust our elections to computers that run on secret proprietary software written and owned by private companies with no way to independently verify our votes. Is this acceptable to you?
Thank you. The questions have to do with electronic voting systems and voter verifiable paper audit trails. And for those of you who may not be familiar with what that means, well, again, Pennsylvania now under the requirements of the Help America Vote Act, there's only two voting systems that can be certified by and large to comply with the requirements of the Help America Vote Act. Those are direct recording electronic devices that are used in Centre County as well as 52 other counties in the state. So 53 counties in the state use these machines that by and large look like ATMs machines. They're touchscreen. And some you can actually touch the screen, others have buttons around that you touch, but that's the concept. The other 14 counties use optical scan. An optical scan is, as we all will recall from school, the bubbles. That system is considered electronic, even though it's on paper. It's considered electronic because the totals are tabulated by a scanner or an electronic tabulator. This question about the voter verifiable paper audit trail refers to the first set of those voting systems, the ones that are used the most in the state, which are the electronic, the direct recording electronic machines, or DREs. And the question is this, or the issue is this. In Pennsylvania, there's not yet a requirement, a legal state requirement, that those machines, when you vote on them, produce a piece of paper that usually is not intended for you to handle. In fact, if you were to give somebody a type of receipt that people can handle, that opens the door for some other issues relative to voter fraud. In Pennsylvania, one of the things we want to guard the most is, again, any type of coercion for the vote, and also in what is known in constitutionally the secrecy of the ballot. And giving someone a piece of paper that people can handle, it opens the door for somebody to say, okay, before you go to the polls, I'll give you $5 if you vote for a certain candidate, but I will only pay you if you're able to show to me that you voted that way. So with a receipt, you probably would be able to do that. But the voter verifiable paper audit trail, as is used in many other states, is not done in a way that you actually handle a piece of paper. With that understanding, what you have is a paper receipt that oftentimes you see under a plexiglass. And what it does is that as you make your selections on the computer, the machine electronically, when you're ready to vote the ballot, you'll get a receipt that says this is how you voted. And at that point in time, if you see any discrepancy, then you can talk to the election official, and that person could probably at that point in time try to invalidate the ballot. Many states have that system in place today. Pennsylvania is likely to move in that direction because there is indeed a great push at the federal level for that type of system to be in place. The reason why you don't have it yet in Pennsylvania, first, we don't have a law that says you as a county have to have that type of technology. But more importantly, in fact, the law doesn't say that you cannot have the system, nor does it say, it doesn't say that you have to, nor it says you can't have it. In the Department of State, we have, in fact, reviewed, the Department of State is the certifying body, is the examining body for voting systems in Pennsylvania, and we have looked at systems that have a voter verifiable paper audit trail component. The reason why it has not yet, not one has yet been certified is because those systems, so far the ones that we have examined, run in a continuous roll of paper, much like a cash register receipt, where the first person who votes is the first person at the top of that list, and is a continuous numbering. As you probably know, when you go to your polling place, you have to sign a ledger. And there are poll watchers in there that, in fact, can sit there and by machine can write down the order in which people voted. Arguably, what people think is far-fetched, you could, in fact, compare the tape from the voter verifiable paper audit trail with the registry. And in that way, you can have a match to see how people voted. And that what that does, in our estimation, is it violates both the Pennsylvania Constitution as well as the Pennsylvania Election Code relative to the secrecy of the ballot. The Department of State is very amenable to the idea of examining systems that will comply with the requirements of the law, and we know that the voting systems manufacturers are working to get us to that point. In terms of the proprietary nature of the systems, when the systems are being when the systems are being certified in Pennsylvania, the vendors have to provide the Department of State, our internal staff, our experts, as well as external experts that we use for certifications, a copy of the source code of the system. So it's not open, it's not public, it's not open source for everybody to see, but the Department of State does see that software. And as much as, you know, in the beginning I talked about the voting system being from not just election day, but being from the moment that that candidates file the petition papers up to the point of the certification of the elections. Even the process for the use of the voting system, people sometimes like to think about just a machine came from a vendor. Vendors say, just trust me and put it there, and you plug it and you go at it. The systems that we have are reviewed at the federal level, and I know there's a lot of discussion about the independent testing authorities on how well they do their job, but the systems are certified at the federal level, they're certified at the state level, and then also keep in mind that There's a lot of discussion about whether you can tamper with the technology, whether you can hack onto the systems. A few things. In Pennsylvania, none of our voting machines, all 25-plus thousand, they're all standalone units. They're not networked, one with the other. So to inject a virus, you will have to do so with every one of the machines. You don't do one and then just infect all the others. That's one thing. You also keep in mind that these machines are not machines that you simply, again, just put out at the polling place for a week before the election and just leave it there for anyone to tamper with those machines. There's a very strict chain of custody for the voting system for the moment. Is certified and is put in a warehouse the day that it's used in the election and returned to the warehouse. So what I'm trying to say with that the complex is that the system in place by the counties is very detailed in terms of who can handle the machines, what you, to access the technology, you will have to access the technology, have to know how, break in, and do so in a way that nobody will be able to know that you're there. And to the best of my knowledge, there's not yet a single case of a proven case of real-life election tampering with voting system that has taken place in the country. So I'm not fully comfortable, but it's where we are in this time and place, and as with everything else, it'll continue to develop, and we certainly will be willing to examine other systems and eventually certify one that has a component for the voter verifiable paper audit trail.
You mentioned candidates just a moment ago. Getting elected to state and national office requires money, lots of it. Some politicians, such as Michael Bloomberg, dip into their personal fortunes to finance campaigns. Is this need for campaign monies discouraging moderate and low-income citizens from running for office? Without them, are we a representative democracy?
I think that, I think that, in fact, having an unlimited ability to tap into campaign finance funding and like Mayor Bloomberg being able to use his own fortune, clearly to me is it can deter people who are of less means to run in the process. So in fact, I like the governor, we both feel very strongly that some form of campaign finance reform needs to take place in Pennsylvania because the playing field is not level at present. That is clear. And I guess it could be argued that since people may be discouraged from running for office, that in fact we're not a representative democracy in its fullest intent. I maintain the faith in that you do have some cases like Governor Jesse Ventura out in Minnesota, regardless of how you feel about how well he administered the business of his state. He was someone who ran a campaign on a very tight budget as a third-party candidate and got elected, and I guess there's ways that to be able to compete, but the reality is that it's very difficult to do, and I do believe that there's a need for campaign reform in Pennsylvania.
Does redistricting have a legitimate purpose? Lately, it seems that voting districts are being drawn to maintain a political or racial majority.
Yeah, redistricting, which takes place every 10 years after the decennial census and is when the boundaries of the state gets redrawn for purposes of our local and state and federal district, is a point of much contention. The law provides that when you do redistricting, you're supposed to do draw districts that are compact, that are contiguous in area, that have some logical form. It's like it would be nice to see blocks, squares of districts, and what you oftentimes see and the phrase used is gerrymandering, where the districts are cut in such a way that they have no rhyme or reason, then arguably opens the door for people to suggest that you somehow cut them in a fashion to allow for some political gain. I do think that that's another area in terms of our election system that needs to be looked into it. And every 10 years, there's a bipartisan commission that works on issues of the redistricting. I encourage anyone who's interested to actively participate in that process and provide public comment. And if you are not happy where you've seen your district or where our state is headed in terms of redistricting, you know, make your voice be heard very adamantly. The good thing about our elections, not only in Pennsylvania but throughout the country, is that you've seen an awakening of the electorate. I think people are beginning to say enough is enough, and you can and and one voice, one vote makes a difference, and enough votes and enough voices expressing concern gets the attention of the elected officials. And I would say that, given our experience in 2006, elected officials will think twice before they act in a way that, you know, that will be counter to the view of a large number of people. So I do encourage you, if you're concerned about the issue, to make your voice be heard.
I'm going to collapse two questions into one. More people cast their vote for last year's American Idol, winner being Taylor Hicks, than voted for George Bush in 2004. And I'll combine this with this. In the 2004 presidential election, only 62% of eligible voters in Pennsylvania actually voted. How can we encourage non-voters to learn about the issues and then vote?
Excellent question. In terms of having more people vote for American Idol, that they will vote in the regular election, this brings to mind the discussion about online voting, which is also something that is being explored. And you have a large number of our populace that feel very comfortable with technology. And I'm not advocating that. We're ways to go there. But that's one thing that facilitates that many more voters. You can vote from the convenience of your house as opposed to having to go to a polling place. But the reality is that in our country, unfortunately, we don't have the level of participation that we ought to have. And oftentimes when we talk about voting, we talk in terms of the privilege or the right to vote. But voting is also a responsibility. As citizens, we have to take an active part in the election of our officials. And it is remarkable to me that we have it fairly easy in our great country, fairly easy to vote. The polls are open for 13 hours. You know, you have many opportunities. And oftentimes, if we have to wait in line for more than 10 minutes, we decide, it's not worth my time. And then you see the people voting in South Africa after apartheid, even in Iraq. And people, you know, walk for, you know, 5-10 miles to vote, and they stand in line, sometimes we take what we have for granted. I guess that's one way to put it. So how do we make that? How do we increase the participation in our electoral process? It really a great deal of that responsibility falls on me and my colleagues throughout the country, doing a better job at getting more information out to the voters, creating that sense of urgency. And I think one of the best examples that we can use to combat this sense that, oh, my vote is won and it doesn't count, is to remind people again about the election, the presidential election of 2000, where arguably, depending on what numbers you look at, the presidency was decided by less than 1,000 votes. And more recently, look at the election for the governor in the state of Washington in the year 2004. More than 3.3 million people voted, and the election was decided by 129 votes. Mathematically, that's 0.00019. And so, in fact, it can make a difference. But it's about education. It's about getting information out. The Department of State had a very comprehensive voter education campaign called Ready, Set, Vote. You may have seen our commercials. You may have gone online and see our information. That's what it takes. You have to get that out. And quite frankly, it's just, you know, working together, having enough interest, having this type of forums to discuss the issues and creating that sense of, again, not only urgency, but the importance of voting. And we have in Pennsylvania, by the way, we have a history of many people who vote and vote regularly. The Department of State has and hosts the Voter Hall of Fame that recognizes people who had voted in at least 50 consecutive elections. So you must be at least 71 to vote, because that was a time when 21 was the minimum age to vote. So far, we have inducted over 12,000 Pennsylvanians on that Voter Hall of Fame. So there's people who have a long history of voting. And when I ask those inductees how come they're so passionate about voting, most of them say it started at home. My parents told me that I had to vote. I could not make up excuses. And I think so. It's incumbent upon all of us to instill those values in our children and our loved ones as well.
I'm holding three excellent questions, but there's only time to ask one of them. Do you think people who pay taxes but hold only a permanent residency card, a green card, would be able to vote in the future?
That will require a constitutional amendment. So in terms of the politics of it, I think we first have to sort out the issue of immigration and immigration reform. I think we will have to get to that first, before we get into a further discussion about expanding the right to vote to other groups. I think there's not yet a point of a sense of consensus on that. I will say, though, that many of the individuals that are working their way through the process of naturalization to become naturalized citizens are very hardworking. And as you noted, they're paying taxes. I think that for the time being, what I would say, encourage those individuals to go through the process, become fully naturalized, become citizens so they're able to vote. I think that those individuals many times are very well informed, very passionate about elections, and I think they will make very good electors. But to get to that point is something beyond today's discussion. It's something that requires more thought, again, and discussion at all levels of government.
All right. I have one final question, but I want to join you at the podium to pose it. But first, I'd like to ask this group to please join me in thanking the Honorable Pedro Cortez for being with us today. Thank you so much. With our tokens of our appreciation, the official Penn State Forum plaque and the Penn State Forum mug. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Don't go away yet, though, because we do have one last question. Governor Rendell recently suggested privatizing the Pennsylvania Turnpike as the first step toward raising revenue to modernize our aging transit system. Might we also think of a legal approach to bringing our roadways into the 21st century by eliminating outdated laws, such as the one requiring a driver who encounters a skittish horse to disassemble his car and hide it in the bushes until the horses have passed, or the one requiring rural nighttime drivers to send up a flare every mile?
See, now you're asking me legal questions, and I try so hard not to play lawyer, you know, but I have to. I'm sure that with time, I could probably find very good, solid arguments for those laws in our state. The reality is some of our laws are very antiquated, and that's why it's so important that we have this type of forums, we have this type of discussions. And again, we are at a crossroad in our history in Pennsylvania. We are at the, you know, we should be so very happy that we're living in today's Pennsylvania, we're making great progress with election laws. We're going to make even more. But we're at a time where our elected officials have, I believe they got the message, both at the state and at the national level, that the voice of the people must be heard. So if you don't like these laws, and I'm not particularly convinced that they're that bad, but if you don't like them, make sure you talk to your elected officials and we get them off the books. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Pedro Cortez speak at the Penn State Forum, recorded January 17, 2007. Copies of the forum are available by calling Media Sales toll-free at 1-800-770-2111. That number again, 800-770-2111. This has been a presentation of Penn State Public Broadcasting.